All right, Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. Generations of Chicagoans woke up to Ray Rayner on weekday mornings on the good old number 9. And while Ray began hosting his early morning cartoon show, his Breakfast with Bugs Bunny, in 1962, it was 1964, 60 years ago, that the show was appropriately named Ray Rayner and His Friends. He also played Bozo the Clown's foil, Oliver O'Oliver. And he also hosted the Dick Tracy Show as Sergeant Pettibone in the 1960s. Now, to talk about Ray's legacy, is children's TV historian Jim Engel, who is also the executive vice president of Surge Innovations.
Hi, David.
What's happening, pal?
So nice to see you
again. It's been a while.
It has been a while.
It's been a while. So there are four people in my lifetime, and I think yours as well, and everyone who's listening out there, that grew up in Chicago, and how lucky we were to have these talented people
Absolutely.
In our lives every day. That's Bob Bell, Frazier Thomas, Bill Jackson, and the man of the hour we're talking about tonight, Ray Rayner.
Ray Rayner. Yeah, and I'd throw Roy Brown in there too, but he was part of the whole Ray Rayner legacy as well. So
he was. He absolutely was. Yeah. First, a little background on Ray. He was a native of New York, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And he was in the Air Corps, and I think this is one of the most fascinating stories I think you know as well.
Yeah, he was a navigator on a B-17 that was shot down over France in 1943. So he spent 2.5 years in POW camps, and that's kind of because, you know, to entertain themselves, they put on camp shows, and that's where he claimed to have gotten his interest in performing. And he was also part of the group that was the people behind the Great Escape, although he was transferred to another camp before that actually happened. But he was part of that as well.
That was pretty cool. So, yeah, POW in Germany for over 2.5 years. That was Steve McQueen and James Garner, I think, in The Great Escape. So, but
and he was German himself.
Was he?
I think Rayner, yeah, I believe so.
Now, he...
his real name, Rahnar.
Right.
I tracked him down once in the phone book that way because I was just like, you wouldn't find Rayner. And I'm like, well, I don't think that's how he spells his name. I wonder if he uses his real spelling. And sure enough, he did.
That's how he got through with that. Now, Ray did some radio in New York and Dayton, Ohio and Grand Rapids. So he was really a radio guy before he landed in Chicago in 53.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's all those guys you mentioned. I mean, every one of those guys had pretty varied careers, you know, and really nobody, none of them set out to be kids show hosts. They did all kinds of stuff, announced staff announcing jobs, radio jobs, and ended up in TV. And so in a lot of cases, the stuff we know them best for is not at all,
what they intended.
A big chunk of their career that had nothing to do with that.
Now, Ray joined what was then WBKB in 53, which later became WBBM-TV in Chicago, as a staff announcer. And he also worked on a local morning program called Rayner Shine in 1953. That was his first gig, right?
Well, yeah, he also was the announcer for Petticoat Party, which was an early Frazier Thomas show that was kind of one of those early shows with a lot of housewives and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of interesting because there again, you think of Ray with a lot of these other guys, and I know for years at WGN, they actually shared a dressing room.
Really?
And if you know their personality types, I guess in real life too, they compare themselves as the odd couple.
I would think so.
Ray was Oscar.
Yeah, I would think so.
And Frazier was Felix. But yeah, so I always find that kind of stuff intriguing because these guys, cross paths in earlier incarnations.
Now the show, even though it was more of an adult morning show, it was, he had puppets on the show and they were provided by the Mole Queens,
is that correct? The Mole Queens, yeah. Yeah, the Mole Queens did a lot of stuff early on. In fact, the Mole Queens even guested on Bozo's, the Bozo Circus show at different times and stuff like that. And Jack Mole Queen was pursuing a puppetry career for a long, long time. So yeah.
Now, then he did host a noontime show called The Ray Rayner Show in 1953, and then which was a little bit more music, comedy skits, dance, pantomime, that type of stuff, and then. It was geared toward teens, though, wasn't it? Was it a teenager show?
Well, he had the Ray Rayner show was a Saturday show, was a dance party show. So, once again, the surviving things that everybody knows is stuff like American Bandstand. But, of course, we had Jim Lounsbury in Chicago and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a dance show on Saturday. And he co-hosted with Mina Kolb, who came out of Second City.
Oh, cool.
And,
okay.
So they had a teenage audience, and he would lip sync records then, too. So it's funny, all the things that we know him for from the Ray Rayner show at some other point or some other show, he did all of it.
You know, later on, as a kid watching it, and we can talk about this a little bit when we get into the Ray Rayner show, but he would sing all these Broadway show tunes or Army songs and be like, what?
Yeah, I know. There's no explaining. To me, a lot of this stuff is strictly because it's early television, earlier television, because you know, so few rules were applied. I mean, you put on a show, you fill the time, and so yeah, it's hard. It's probably impossible to imagine a show like what became the Ray Rayner Show being produced or even proposed today. You know.
Then he moved to WBBM, and he produced a show. It was called The Little Show, which was his first kid show, I guess.
Yes, right.
And he had a duck.
He had a duck, and that duck was called.
So at Havelock?
Havelock. And Havelock, I remember him in an interview saying, it was sort of like an inside joke, they named the duck Havelock after the author Havelock Ellis, who was known for some kind of, you know, a little more adult material. So I guess that was a little bit of an inside joke.
Oh, that's nice.
Which I guess they were never above that.
But never on any of the shows. Now, it ran a couple of years. He also hosted a show called Popeye's Firehouse.
Yeah, I remember Popeye's Firehouse.
Really?
Myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was born in 56, so Popeye's...
You were not, really?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Right.
Popeye's Firehouse was from 59 to 61, so it's an early TV memory for me, you know, and it, again, you think about it, now there was another Popeye show with John Coughlin called USS Popeye, which was set on a boat, and John Coughlin, the weatherman, did other shows. He was on a show called Breakfast House where he was a cowboy called Buffalo Nichols. But, I mean, like, who comes up with the idea of Popeye being hosted by a fireman in a firehouse, you know? So, but he was Chief Abernathy. He was like
worked.
A big mustachioed guy with the barber pole, with the fire pole and all that stuff.
Now, Ray joined GN then in 61, and it was a legendary year for Chicago television because, number one, WGN Television Studios opened at Bradley Place, and Bozo Circus officially hit the airwaves.
Yeah,
and he played Oliver, which was kind of a country bumpkin kind of. See, this is before my time. I was born in 67, so I'm kind of the cookie
era. No, I remember Oliver very well. Oliver was Ray doing like a kind of like a hillbilly voice and basically playing a fall guy. Even actually like on the stupidity level, you know, less more stupid than even Cookie. You know what I mean? He was much more gullible and he was kind of the foil for those guys. And he wore the straw hat and he had a big rubber nose and kind of weird makeup if you've ever seen it in close up, little mustache and stuff like that. But yeah, he did that.
Did he wear a mustache? I don't remember seeing that.
Okay. Well, right. It's under the big rubber nose, so maybe you didn't notice.
We were talking about the 60th anniversary of WGN TV's The Ray Rayner Show with children's TV historian Jim Engel, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. All right, a little Clutch Cargo for you as we celebrate the Ray Rayner Show on WGN TV that debuted 60 years ago with TV children's historian Jim Engel. So Ray was on Bozo. He had his own show, and he also hosted an afternoon show featuring Dick Tracy.
Right, and Dick Tracy was a great show. That's one of my earlier television memories as well. And, of course, I'm particularly partial to puppets. So in a lot of ways, some of my favorite moments of the stuff he's done involve puppets. And
sure.
Of course, they had the Tracer puppet on that show, which was voiced and manipulated by a guy named Ron McAdam, but was created by Roy Brown. And
who created a lot of these.
Did a lot of the really cool puppets. In fact, the first time I met Roy back in the early 80s, I went out to his house, and he had the Tracer puppet there sitting on a tabouret next to his drawing board. And it's a very cool puppet, and it's got a lot of, you know, cool fun. It's very expressive, moving eyes and eyebrows and stuff. And a lot of people don't remember this about it, but it was named in a contest, and the prize was a puppy if you named this dog. But Ray showed the, besides the Dick Tracy cartoons, he showed a series called QT Hush, which people of a certain age remember. It was a detective cartoon of a guy, and he had a sidekick dog named Seamus. So Tracer was presented as this was the nephew of this cartoon dog that needed a name. So actually, the Roy's puppet looks, you know, a good deal like the cartoon dog as well.
But just like you said, these performers in the early days of television, especially local television, they had so many other jobs. I heard Bob was dressed up at 6:15 in the morning in a suit to do the news and the weather and so forth before even getting ready for Bozo.
And if you were up listening to, you know, watching, Ray Rayner, actually, and there'd be the news breaks and stuff ahead of time. And, you know, and as a kid, a lot of times, of course, you don't put these voices together because he had a really great, deep announcer voice, a really good voice. And you wouldn't have necessarily known that was him. But then back when I was a kid, we didn't even realize he was Andy Starr on the Three Stooges
too. Yeah, exactly. So then Ray added a third show in 1962 when he took over from Dick Coughlin, who I just found out, and I didn't know this, was a weatherman, hosting Breakfast with Bugs Bunny every day at 7.
Well, yeah, Dick Coughlin, actually, in all the years that I've been researching this stuff and digging things up, Dick Coughlin is the mystery man of early TV. Nobody, I've asked everybody.
Well, you figured out something here because I didn't know that even.
What?
That he was a weatherman.
Oh, no, that was John Coff.
Oh, John. You're talking about John. So John Coughlin, and Dick, not related?
No, they're not.
Okay.
Famous, but Dick Coughlin was the guy who hosted Breakfast with Bugs Bunny. He kind of wore like a plaid shirt, and he was outdoors. And they did the thing similar to the way the early BJ and Dirty Dragon things worked, where Bill Jackson would stand next to the post office and reach his arm around the back and work the puppet. Dick Coughlin would be standing next to a rocket with the spaceman in it or a tree with one of the animals like Bugs Bunny in it. And he'd work the puppets. Now, Roy Brown built those puppets. Coughlin did the voices. I've asked Roy about that and Don Sandberg, who wrote a lot of that show. But strangely enough, Coughlin is the guy that nobody knows what became of him. I have been looking for years.
Really?
I've gone through phone directories. I've researched his kids. Nobody, I've talked to old-timers at WGN. Nobody knows what happened.
So that's what you do as a television historian. You got to dig around
right,
in this
exactly.
stuff. And I remember seeing in the Bozo Garn Ray thing that George Pappas and Dean and Jeff Hoover put together. I see his picture.
That picture came from me. And
was it really?
Yeah, and I remember the day I found that picture out at the Kane County Fairgrounds. Of all the years I've been digging up kid show stuff, that was one of my favorite discoveries of all time because I'd never seen a really good photo of that guy. And actually, when I was a young, a little kid, I kind of confused the two. I had a memory that Ray Rayner was with those puppets because you'd never see any pictures of Dick Coughlin, you know. So
it was really a morning show for every age because he was talking to adults too.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, one thing that all the WGN hosts have in common, Ray and Frazier, Bob Bell, they all felt that the first obligation of children's television was to entertain. And then if after that there was some kind of aspect of, you know, education, whatever, great. But that was always secondary, you know.
So, right, yeah.
And Ray is a perfect example. Well, you make this observation about a lot of people who do entertainment that bridges those gaps. And it's generally, whether it's the Muppets or the guys that made Rocky and Bullwinkle or the Looney Tunes guys, basically they were doing what they found amusing. And if the rest of the world, whatever age, caught on to it, that was great. And I think that's kind of the common thread in all this kind of
stuff. It was kind of the secret behind it,
sure.
Yeah. Now, it was often, you know, beat in the ratings, the Today Show, Good Morning America, and the weekdays, CBS, Sunday Morning News combined. So many people. I mean, you were getting sports. You were getting weather with Mary D.
Oh, yeah.
On the air listening to that.
I mean, well into my adulthood, as like many people, you know, it was the thing I had on in the morning as I was getting ready for work. And, you know, if a Bugs Bunny cartoon came on or something, I might stop what I was doing to watch that as well.
Now, his jumpsuits, I think, started at WBBM. I think he got them at Sears for like $5,
didn't
he?
Yeah, that's what they say. And the jumpsuits, you know, that stuff goes back. That was part of the little show. You know, people, the other thing I find interesting about a lot of this is we were introduced to these things based on your age on that particular show. But he had on that little show, he had the jumpsuit, he had the notes, he had the duck, a lot of the things that we think of as specifically, you know, he was 10 years prior to WGN doing a lot of that same kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
This was the show that kind of launched it.
If I digress a minute back to Cuddly Dudley, which I love.
No, I was just going to ask you about him. Yeah.
You know, Cuddly Dudley was, many people remember this, it was part of a Tribune promotion. If you subscribe to the Tribune, you got the Cuddly Dudley dog, which was a big stuffed animal. And over the years, it came in a variety of boxes that converted into everything from rockets to trains, etc. So it was a very popular promotion, but to make it more so, they had Roy turn him into a puppet. And he literally just took one of the stuffed dogs and cut it open and worked it. It had moving ears and an open and closing mouth. But the great thing was, those are my favorite moments on the show because between the two of them, those are golden moments. They were just goofing around, you know, and they didn't really know what they're going to do. They're hugely ad-libbed. And my absolute favorite memory of Cuddly Dudley was one morning, Ray had announced that he was going to have a guest on the show that was one of these guys that stands in a department store window like at Marshall's Fields and can be like a mannequin. He can stand that still.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, so he's telling Cuddly Dudley this, and Cuddly goes, well, what do you mean, Ray? And he's like, well, he just stands perfectly still, and it's almost like he's a statue or something. And Roy has Cuddly Dudley say, well, I can do that. And he pulls his hand out of the puppet, and it flops over in the doghouse. And it's just laying there, like, with its mouth open. And there's, like, a long beat, and Ray's like, okay, Cud, that's great. You know, he left it. He milked it for everything it was worth.
That's awesome.
Leaving Ray with nothing to do, and the puppet just flopped over on its side.
There was also Chelveston, as you were mentioning. And, you know, you and I, again, got to be at WGN when we did, George Pappas Dean and Jeff Hoover did Bozo Garn Ray. We brought all the stuff back from the museum. We had the Animal Kingdom there with supposedly.
Supposedly the animal kingdom, Bernie Hoffman's animal kingdom, has kept track of the lineage of Chelveston the duck, so that while, of course, there were many over the years, they brought in a duck for that event that they said is the direct descendant of Chelveston. And as I recall, we were there that day, Dave, all day.
Yeah.
I had this single honor of cleaning up Chelveston's droppings on the set.
Sorry.
So, yeah.
Named
but literally, I will tell you this, there was one guy there that was gathering up feathers when they fell off. So the fanaticism for this stuff knows no bounds. You know, I didn't keep what I cleaned up, but that guy
good for you. It was named after the RAF Chelveston, where Ray Rayner was stationed during World War II. More with Jim Engel on the 60th anniversary of the Ray Rayner Show after the news next. That was the theme from Ray's Ark in the Park segment that was done with Dr. Lester Fisher.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, the Irish Rovers. I still remember the opening because they'd show a picture of whatever animal they were mentioning, but then when they got to unicorn, I think they showed a turtle or something.
That's nice. That's pretty typical of what
another,
we saw.
Another super well-remembered aspect of the show, but another great example of, you know, basically the incongruity of Ray, who didn't like being around animals, doing an animal segment with Fisher. And of course, Fisher himself, his old delivery was kind of droll and low key and stuff. So it made for an interesting segment.
But it was cool because, I mean, I remember him being at the zoo hanging out. I thought that was so cool. Yeah. And, you know, my family, I think, took us a lot to Brookfield Zoo. And it made me want to go to Lincoln Park Zoo because it was Dr. Lester Fisher was there.
Yeah, I was a Brookfield kid, too. But yes, Fisher introduced me to Lincoln Park Zoo.
So they really just kind of took you through the zoo. They took you through some of the animals. Was it a weekly segment? Was it a daily segment? I don't remember.
I mean, don't put me on the spot. I don't know, but it was it was a semi-regular.
Semi-regular.
It wasn't every day. No, it's probably weekly.
Okay, fair enough.
You'll get a text or email now about this.
Bugs Bunny and Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes cartoons were famously played. I mean, that's where I knew I could. That's how I got introduced to Bugs Bunny.
You know, and the funny thing is, I as an adult, I became a film collector as well, like 16 millimeter films and stuff. And the amazing thing was, the way that worked is that they'd sell a package of cartoons to a station like WGN. And people that know film know this. Over time, prints of film turn a reddish. It's called going red.
Oh, they're awful. I remember that.
But the funny thing is, later on, when I met some of the Looney Tunes directors like Bob Clampett, and it became a friend of mine. And you'd see the actual cartoons, and you'd realize, oh, those cartoons had like greens and purples in them. But we grew up watching those red WGN prints, so you just had no sense of the color of them. But actually, I have a strong nostalgia for that because that was what introduced me to those cartoons, and those are like my favorite cartoons.
So I was born in the late 60s, and so when I finally saw, I think it was on CBS, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour or whatever it was, that's when I discovered what the cartoons actually looked like.
Yeah, right.
I hate to say it.
But the Warner Brothers package that WGN had was like the earlier stuff, which was great.
Yes, it was
the really, really classic stuff.
Now, there were other cartoons and other segments that were played during the show. What were some of the others?
Well, they did, you know, over the years, they did Hanna-Barbera cartoons. You know, they would change out the paintings on that back set for whatever cartoons they had. So for a while, Snagglepuss was on there and Yogi Bear. So they also showed the Jay Ward cartoons, which were obviously great. And then Gumby, which I, you know, was introduced to Gumby on Ray's show, and I grew up to love Gumby. I'm a huge Gumby fan. But I think probably more than the thing people remember more than anything, in the same way that people associate Clutch Cargo with Garfield Goose and Friends, would be Diver Dan, which was a great show that was produced out of Philadelphia, I believe, and it was started in 1960. And these guys had this great idea of filming marionette fish through an aquarium with real fish in it, and then the only live people were Diver Dan in his big diving suit with the big round helmet, and one of my early childhood crushes, Miss Minerva, the mermaid, who was, and she was, if you go back and look, she was really, really beautiful.
This is a weekday morning kid show. Wasn't there a smoking fish, smoked underwater?
The heroes of the show were Finley and Chumley, and the villains were Baron Barracuda, who was like a Germanic baron with a monocle, and his sidekick Trigger, who was a typical moron with a cigarette dangling in his mouth. And they had this standard routine, like, you know, he would say, Baron. He goes, "Hey, boss." And Baron would say, "Don't call me boss. Call me Baron, stupid." And then he goes, "All right, Baron, stupid." You know, but everybody remembers Trigger. I mean, particularly.
Let's take a little listen to Diver Dan, and then the adventure would begin.
Yeah, and they were cliffhangers. It was like a serial scene. Diver Dan would have his air hose trapped or cut off by the Baron or whatever.
But the set is so iconic. And, you know, it was a very simple set. I mean, it was just a three walls that they would tear down every day and put back up in front of the Bozo seating.
Right.
Is where it used to go.
Right. And they had, you know, they had certain iconic things. They had that wall clock that was painted with the graphics around it to make it look like it was an alarm clock going off, and that kind of spattered paint treatment with the big Mondrian lines around it and stuff. I have a very strong memory of the turtle race thing that he did, which, you know, today there'd probably be a problem with that too. But he had little painted turtles with numbers on their backs, and he'd have, a concentric circle thing, and he'd start them off in the middle. And, of course, you know, turtles don't go very fast. But, of course, in those days, TV shows didn't go very fast either. So.
Now, part of the old set, I think literally the old set, the desk is still at WGN, but it's been painted over because they repurposed all this stuff.
Did.
That's,
you know,
one of the things we didn't save.
No, and you know something? I've had people contact me over the years with questions about this or that, or I think I have this prop or that prop or whatever. But what nobody realizes about the way that television worked, and particularly like at WGN, it was like it was commerce. It wasn't art. You know, nobody revered this stuff. Nobody treated it beautifully. No. If you go to the museum, there's a certain charm to how beat up everything actually is. And I mean that. I mean, it's kind of cool to see that. But they just used it, you know?
Well, at the Broadcast Museum, and that's at museum.tv, 360 North State Street, what I did is had, and Jim has curated stuff for the museum for years, and that's actually where you met. Did you meet Ray at the Puppets Pies and Prizes, the first exhibit you did at the old museum?
The first time I met Ray was in 95 when Bob Surratt and Marianne Murciano had him in the morning as co-host for a week, and I loaned them.
Thing.
Diver Dan clips and some photos, and they invited me down. But then Puppets, Pies, and Prizes, Kids TV Chicago style, which kicked off in 2001 and was supposed to run for like 6 months and ran for like 6 years, I was involved in the junior board and produced like the Bill Jackson visits and stuff like that. But that was the big one. And for the opening day of that event, we had everybody that was still alive that we could get, seriously.
How cool.
So Ray was there, Bill Jackson was there, John Connor, Mary Hartline, Sandy, all these people together. And boy, Ray, you know, the funny thing with all those people, we told them they'd be signing some autographs. Well, no one, the line was out the door and around the block.
Course,
the fire marshal almost shut the museum down. But all
did.
Of those people were like, you know, like the traditional, like old boxer when the bell goes off or the old racehorse. They sat there all day. And honestly, I think one of the greatest joys of my life was to stand back after putting that whole event together and watch people go past the autograph table, you know, talking to Ray Rayner and Bill Jackson and Jack Mulqueen. And these guys, I don't know, it's like they had an energy that lasted all day.
They
were so high off of that experience.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, as an adult, but I visited the Bozo show twice. I was at the 30th anniversary show, and I used to design toys for a company that donated toys for the grand prize game, so I went there that way. But I will say everybody that went in there probably had the same initial thought. I can't believe how small this is when you're in there. And they crammed you in on those seats and put those things in front of it. But, you know, on TV, everything looks huge. So
now, for the Broadcast Museum, what we did is I had one of, at my ad agency, which I do during the week, I had a young designer who was 28 at the time, who obviously never saw the Ray Rayner show. I had George Pappas from WGN send us as many pictures as he could because there's not a lot of video. There's only a handful of shows I think the museum has or that actually exist. Out of the tens of thousands, there's very few left. Now, the last show ran on December 18th, 1980. Actually, I think that was the first run episode. It ended in January. Let's take a listen a little bit to how Ray would end the show. Ray died 10 years ago. He was gone 10 years ago, and his legacy lives on again at the Broadcast Museum.
Yeah, I actually remember, I was actually overseas on a business trip and heard about his death, and I think came back, and the very next day went on with Dean to do a tribute to Ray. And shortly after Ray, just parenthetically, Captain Kangaroo died too, so it was not like the greatest time. But yeah, Ray, I mean, you know, the fact that WGN produced that special, which people watch every year, and I still go get phone calls from people, do you know this is on? Or, hey, I just heard your name mentioned. I mean, people of a certain age watch it every year. But those are the people that are the enduring guys.
Three guys with a lot of passion, and that's Dean Richards, of course, and George Pappas, who's the executive producer, and Jeff Hoover. You know, that was the last time all the props, because the museum was closed at the time, we brought every prop that we had, the grand prize game and all that stuff back to the studio. That was a pretty cool day, I must admit.
Oh, it was a wonderful day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that was the second or third time I had the, you know, I dressed all the mannequins and set up the Gar puppets, which has always been always an amazing. But, you know, you talk about Ray Rayner's legacy. I was thinking about this, and, you know, there are certain performers. A good example to me is one of my favorites, Jimmy Durante. Was he the funniest guy in the world? No. Was he the best singer? No. Did he have the best material, the best movies? No. But there's a certain school of entertainment where people love the personality. You know, that's what they like. It didn't matter what he was doing.
It's true.
And I think that's why Ray Rayner has the legacy that he has. Because, honestly, it's sad that there aren't a lot of clips. no one's going to be totally blown away by any of the clips, except maybe from a nostalgia standpoint, because we don't have the opportunity to look at enough of it. But I think because he was the guy that he was, bungling, affable, funny, he liked to sing, he loved all the Broadway stuff, he was obviously a ham, and you know, in real life besides that, he was in theater a lot.
He was,
all that stuff. But it's really, ultimately, I think more than any single thing you can point at, because it's hard to point at anything and go, oh, that was really great. It's
him. True.
You know,
it's true.
People just liked him.
Well, because he kind of represented us, because a lot of us may be bumbling through it ourselves.
Right. He was just a likable guy. And I know when he died, I remember Sandy saying, what a great, Don Sandberg, what a great performer he was.
Expressive face
and stuff. So he was into it, you know. I don't, and it came through.
That was fun, Jim. Let's do this again soon.
Anytime you'd like, Dave. It was great to be here. And of course, this is a topic we love, right?
It is. It is. Chicago Children's Television historian Jim Engel. Thanks, pal.